Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Fright Night Friday, bonus episode number 2 of Haunted History October. Last Friday's bonus episode was on the origin of the vampire, but tonight, Friday the 13th, we have something for you that's darker, spookier, and entirely real. Imagine an entire community under a spell, an invisible threat that forces the masses to turn on each other, to cast aspersions, to point fingers. Neighbors become enemies, and enemies take each other down. You can trust no one, as even members of your own family begin whispering under their breath, "Witch, witch." This is what happened to the folks of Salem, Massachusetts in 1692. For less than a year, the community seemed to suffer a bout of collective insanity as it persecuted over 200 of its own. Many died under the weight of false accusation of witchcraft and devil worshiping. But what was the source of this wave of hysteria? Was it a deal with the devil or just a plain old frenzy? Let's find out together as we delve into tonight's special Friday the 13th episode on the Salem Witch Trials. This episode contains depictions of mental illness, racism, collective insanity, suicide, and torture. Today, we're taken back to the town that we visited last week, Danvers, Massachusetts. At the time that our story starts, 1692, this town is known as Salem Village. In the greater Salem area, there lived about 2,000 souls, whereas the smaller Salem Village was home to roughly 500 to 600. Salem Town was a prosperous port town bordered by the Atlantic Ocean. It boasted a booming harbor, which in turn generated a fair amount of wealth. Because of its strategic location, Salem Town was able to generate merchant trade with the East and Europe. And as often is the case, wealth begets wealth. As such, mainly rich families and merchants settled in the town, bringing with them money and power. Bordering Salem Town, by contrast, was the rural community of Salem Village. This larger area was made up of scattered farmhouses. Most of the villagers, as it was, were poorer farming families. Life in colonial America was dreadful and daunting. Because the success and for some survival of many villagers depended on the bounty of their crops, most would spend their days laboring for hours on end. The wealth gap between the affluent townsfolk and the poor farming villagers was extensive. The overall demarcation between poor and prosperous was searing. Because of this, resentment brewed, laying the groundwork for what can be easily seen as social, political, and financial stress for both communities. The dichotomy between them carries another implication, one beyond the normal shame and misfortune that plagues financial inequity. You see, the residents of Salem were directly descended from those who boarded the Mayflower ship that reached the shores of America on the 9th of November, 1620. And that brood, as you may or may not know, were separatist Puritans intent on practicing their religion free from persecution in what they saw as the New World. One of the tenets of Puritanism is that your ascension to heaven or hell is a preordained fact, one of which you aren't privy to in your mortal life. For this reason, Puritans lived in a state of constant spiritual anxiety, never knowing if they were one of the chosen few. Hoping for a sign that they were one of those destined for salvation as opposed to damnation, they would often search for signs of God's favor in their everyday lives. And so, this is how the people of Salem lived, their lives plunged into hardship, destitution, and spiritual stress. You see, the people of Salem Village saw themselves as distinct enough from the haughty, opulent townspeople of Salem Town that they were actively hoping for their own congregation. They wanted religious independence. At the time our story starts, Salem Village was in the process of securing its own ordained minister, allowing the community to practice in its own congregation. As a little tangent, it should be stated that a little under 10 years before our story starts, a man named Increase Mathers, yes, you heard that right, took it upon himself to write a little book. Now, Increase was, at the time, a New England puritanical minister, as well as the newly sworn president of a little place called Harvard College. Well before his tenure, there had been sort of a mass movement in Europe, one involving the hunting and execution of witches. In 1681, as Increase began writing his book, which would be one of many, the movement in Europe was dwindling, having spanned the better part of the last 100 years. Now, what was this book, you ask? Well, his book, titled Remarkable Providences, was published in 1684 and was a compendium of knowledge aimed at showcasing the very real power of witchcraft. Increase's son, Cotton Mathers, yes, again, you heard right, would follow in his father's footsteps 5 years later, publishing pamphlets on witchcraft, meaning there already existed an undercurrent of witchcraft being a very tangible and real thing, having been bolstered by two men that were deemed prominent and reputable within the community. A belief in the supernatural was prevalent. It could be used to explain failing crops, for instance, or illness in the family. This belief, no doubt, helped fuel the hysteria. Now, back to our story. The first ordained minister that served the residents of Salem Village was a man named Samuel Paris. Paris was the first minister to be officially ordained after four other men had tried and failed to secure the job. Other ministers, such as a man named George Burroughs, had defected from the position due to lack of payment. Burroughs' paycheck, however, was directly tied to the collection of local taxes, so it's almost as though he was ousted by the populace by proxy. Paris, for his part, was voted in, but only barely so. What's more, he accepted the position with the excitement of a man asked to swallow a bucket of eels. He was reprehensive and bordered on insulting with his reluctance to take the position. He waited a long time before accepting, causing nervousness and a sense of insult within the village. This, of course, did nothing to help settle the rising tension brewing in Greater Salem. The village was on edge, full of envy for the opulent townsfolk, filled to the brim with exhaustion from the days that were coated in labor, and both seemed to fold into each other in an endless succession of mindless work. The townspeople, for their part, carried open disdain and were reluctant to honor the right of the villagers to practice in their own space of devotion. As the people in power, they saw this as a slippery slope. What's more, the winter of 1691 to 1692 had been the harshest one yet. You could say the cauldron was already brewing. Paris's style when it came to serving the people of Salem Village was harsh and caused further division. When he was called upon to weigh in on conflicts, for instance, he was in the habit of zeroing in on the smallest moral indiscretions and implementing very harsh punishments as a result. This, of course, did nothing to soothe the community. It should be added that the Puritan colonists who disembarked from the Mayflower expected a bountiful land that would be emblematic of their spiritual journey, one where they could practice freely and live a dutiful, pious life filled with opportunity. Once they arrived, however, the shocking truth was quite different. At the time this story unfolds, English colonists and the French-supported Wabanaki people of the territory had been waging relentless campaigns against each other for years. The residents, of course, became fearful of the other and lay in a constant state of hypervigilance. What's more, Massachusetts at this time was in a type of political limbo. Its old charters had become obsolete, and the current rulers of the colony, Simon Bradstreet and Thomas Danforth, were still operating as governor and deputy governor, but their positions held no real authority. And so, the colony waited for a new charter. But, in the interim, it was led by a local government that was very religious, with a lot of political weight being carried by the ministers. So in January of 1692, in Salem Village, after a winter of desolation and riding on the coattails of political, religious, social, and communal division and unrest, two young girls, 9-year-old Elizabeth Betty Paris and 11-year-old Abigail Williams, the daughter and niece, respectively, of Puritan Reverend Samuel Parris, began displaying fits of hysteria. The girls would experience uncontrolled fits of bodily movements, speak in strange tongues, contort their bodies, run around, scream, climb over and under furniture, and complain about feeling like their bodies were being pricked with pins. For a month, the girls were instructed by their elders to fast and to pray. They were also treated with home remedies. However, their symptoms did not subside. As a result, a local doctor, William Griggs, was called upon. Samuel Parris had been the person who called the doctor, believing initially that the girls' fits were a result of something being medically wrong with them. The doctor, as it was, could not find anything wrong, at least physically, with the girls. It was at this moment that he officially diagnosed the girls as being bewitched. Around the end of February, the Parris' neighbor, a woman named Mary Sibley, is said to have urged a woman named Tituba and her husband, John Indian, both enslaved and working in the Parris household, to bake a witch cake. It was thought that this cake could be used as a tool to identify the source of the children's calamity, some sort of simple charm or counter magic, if you will. The cake, a mixture of rye meal or barley or oats, and the children's urine was then fed to the family dog, who would in turn point them to the witch. The making of the witch cake is an interesting historical point of contention, as it's unclear whether or not the cake was made in order to identify sources of magical making, or if it was an act of magical making in itself. Regardless, Tituba got the short end of the stick in this situation and was quickly cornered and accused of witchcraft herself. Soon, other girls in the village began displaying similar symptoms as Betty and Abigail. Quickly added to the list of bewitched girls were 12-year-old Ann Putnam and 17-year-old Elizabeth Hubbard, who reported being attacked by spectral forces and apparitions. The residents of Salem, beaten down by a harsh winter, fatigued by constant infighting and struggling under the weight of their fate, pressured the girls. Overly pious, the Puritans also believed that the quarreling was the way of the devil, and so the girls were heavily pressured by the adults to publicly name their aggressors. It turns out they cast their aspersions upon three easy targets. The first was Tituba. Tituba was the West Indian slave of Samuel Parris. She had been a caretaker for the children. It's important to note that some source material state that Tituba is from the Caribbean or that she could have also been Native American. On March 1st, the three women accused were brought to the meeting house in Salem Village. This is where the accused were routinely brought for pre-trial examinations. There, they were examined by two local magistrates, John Hathorne, who we mentioned in our last episode, and Jonathan Corwin. After being heavily pressed, Tituba confessed and implicated the other two women, Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne. One could imagine that because of her low standing in the community and the enormity of pressure that she was under, Tituba was left with no choice but to throw the other two women under the bus. What's more, it was reported afterwards that Tituba was most likely heavily beaten by Samuel Parris in order to get her to confess and also name her accomplices. It's even said that Samuel Parris threatened to withhold the payment of her jail bond should she not implicate the others involved. Now, it's easy to fathom why Tituba was singled out first. Because of her ancestry, Tituba had darker skin, which would have immediately made her othered in the community. What's more, there were tales floating around about how she told the children inappropriate stories or may have done some little rituals with them to tickle their fancy. What's more, her connection to Samuel Parris cannot be understated, as we will soon see. Sarah Good, for her part, was the daughter of a wealthy tavern owner. When she was just 16 years old, Sarah Good's father died by suicide, leaving her penniless as she was robbed of her inheritance. She then married an indentured servant, who also ended up dying quite quickly, leaving her with nothing except a pregnant belly. Sarah Good was left begging on the streets in order to get by. However, she didn't go about it the endearing route. No. Sarah Good was rumored to have been spiteful and mean. And, well, can we blame her? Sarah Osborne, on the other hand, was married to the wealthy brother-in-law to the Putnam family. When he died, she also married an indentured servant and took control of her late husband's estate, wrestling this control from her sons. This had created a legal battle that involved the Putnam family. Now, if you recall, Ann Putnam was one of the girls that was supposedly bewitched. The women were all jailed. They had all claimed their innocence, of course. The frenzy, however, was only building. All through March, more women were accused of witchcraft. It did appear, however, that the accusations were more targeted. For example, Dorothy Good, Sarah Good's 4-year-old daughter, was accused of being a witch. She was put to interrogation, with every word uttered by her cute little mouth being used against her. The next person accused was Martha Corey, a woman who was very vocal about how ridiculous she thought this whole witchcraft ordeal was. Originally, Martha and her husband, Giles, even attended pre-trial examinations at the Salem Village Meeting House. However, she grew increasingly suspicious about their validity, ultimately pressuring her husband not to attend them by hiding his riding saddle. Martha was ultimately highly skeptical and did not trust the girl's accusations. Because of this outward disdain, she came into the crosshairs of the accusers pretty quickly and was singled out as a witch. Rebecca Nurse was next in line. Now here, we have two women who were actually held in high esteem by members of the community. Both Martha Corey and Rebecca Nurse were members of their churches in Salem Village and Salem Town, respectively. They were pious, respectable women, which kind of created a shadow of uncertainty for a spell. However, this feeling was quickly overcome by a tremor of fear. Because if Martha Corey and Rebecca Nurse could be accused of witchcraft, who would be next? On March 1st, 1692, the first trial began. All women pleaded innocent, at first. However, Tituba, most likely thinking that a confession could spare her life, relented. She confessed to signing a book of the devil under the duress of the Sarahs. Initially reluctant, it was against her will that she did so. For a little extra flourish, Tituba added that she saw 6 other names in the book, although she was unable to clearly make out whose names they were. On March 25th, Sarah Good took the stand. The courtroom was hostile, the villagers positively foaming at the mouth. What's more, the jury was comprised mostly of the relatives of the accused children, and all men. It was, of course, a terrible conflict of interest. To add even more dramatic flair to the whole event, the accusing children were in attendance in the courtroom. When Sarah Good entered the courtroom, they moaned and rocked back and forth. One of the children began having a fit and then stated that she had been attacked by a knife. She then produced half of a broken knife. A young man that was present in the courtroom quickly countered her statement, saying that the knife was his and that the girl had witnessed him breaking it in town the previous day. It's even stated that he presented the other half of the knife as proof. The judge scolded the little girl for exaggerating, but allowed the whole scene to be considered altogether as evidence, nonetheless. This whole scene falls under the banner of spectral evidence, and this tactic would be the backbone of the Salem witch trials. Repeatedly, the girls would claim to be attacked by some projected form controlled by the accused women. As a sidebar, our friend, Cotton Mather, of witchcraft pamphlet fame, was generally pleased by the trials. However, he let it be known that he drew the line at spectral evidence. There was a plethora of additional methods used to identify witches and strengthen arguments in order to lead to a conviction. One of these methods was the touch test. This is when one of the accused would touch a victim that was having a fit. If the victim stopped convulsing, it meant that the person touching them was the person responsible for causing the fit in the first place. Flawless logic. The good Reverend John Hale resumed the logic as such. He says, quote, "The witch, by the cast of her eye, sends forth a malefic venom into the bewitched to cast him into a fit, and therefore the touch of the hand doth by sympathy cause that venom to return into the body of the witch again." End quote. Other forms of evidence, aside from the accused witches selling each other out, was the presence of poppets. A poppet is a doll made to represent a person in the spellcasting process. It can be made of natural fibers or anything available and shaped into the rough draft version of a human stick figure. The poppet is a vessel, an effigy, whereupon the energies transferred to it are destined to the targeted person, kind of like a voodoo doll, if you will. Skin lesions, dubbed devil's marks or witch's marks, were also used to identify witches. A devil's mark, it was said, was proof that a contract between the accused and the devil had been made. These marks could be flat or raised, red, blue, brown. Lesions, unusual outlines, anything really. As for witch's marks, they were most often the fabled third nipples, like a mole or a blemish, referred to as a witch's teat. It was often reported that the witch's familiar or magical pet would feed off of said nipple for sustenance. Another method was the dunking method. In this method, the accused witch would be tied up and dunked into a body of water in order to determine whether that person would sink or float. Floating indicated that that person was guilty. Again, flawless logic. The home of the accused would often be scoured, and a pot of ointment could be enough to evoke suspicion. Often, women who tended to live on the fringe of what was perceived as acceptable in a Puritan society were targeted. Women who quite literally lived outside the town, who dabbled in natural remedies, who dressed differently, secured land, and spoke their minds, would easily come into the line of fire. Sarah Osborne would be the first casualty of the Salem witch trials, as she would die in jail in May, awaiting her trial and execution. Sarah Good, as you can imagine, protested against the accusations consistently. However, she didn't shy away from throwing Tituba and Sarah Osborne under the bus herself, stating that it was they who were in fact the real witches. Sarah Good was ultimately found guilty and was thrown in jail. While in jail, she gave birth to a baby who did not survive. She would be executed on July 19th of that year. Upon her march to the gallows, after being urged to confess to save her soul, she is said to have uttered, quote, "You are a liar. I am no more a witch than you are a wizard, and if you take my life, God will give you blood to drink." End quote. Along with Sarah Good, Rebecca Nurse, Susanna Martin, Elizabeth Howe, and Sarah Wilds were also executed on a place called Proctor's Ledge. In order to deal with the slew of perceived witchcraft, in May of 1692, the colony created the Court of Oyer and Terminer, which translates as to hear and determine in Salem Town. This court was put in place in order to deal with the inordinate amount of people who had been jailed for witchcraft. The first person that this special court tried was a woman named Bridget Bishop. Bridget was seen as not adhering to the puritanical code, which in this case is a very loose observation. She always dressed in black and wore strange outfits. She was found guilty and executed in June of that year. Hers was the first execution in the Salem witch trials. Following Bridget's execution, there was a 20-day recess, upon which members of the court conferred with reputable New England ministers. It was a little brush-up in order to see if everyone was more or less satisfied with the dealings of the day, or, as they said, upon things as they stood. And apparently, they saw no wrong in their doings. Cotton Mather was the spokesperson, and he proclaimed that the Court of Oyer and Terminer was doing right by the people in, he says, as quote, "fighting off molestations from the invisible world," end quote. Members of the court included Salem Town magistrates, such as John Hathorne, Jonathan Corwin, and Bartholomew Gedney, who all served as judges. These men, it should be noted, all possessed money and power. With this bolstered and self-righteous energy came quick waves of accusations, short trials, and even more executions. Another person swept up in the wave was Martha Carrier. Martha was accused of witchcraft by Roger Toothaker, who claimed that his many cattle had suffered strange deaths after he and Martha Carrier had a little argument. A little girl named Phoebe Chandler also accused Martha Carrier, saying that she had heard her whispering that she would poison her. Shortly after, Phoebe reported being stricken with terrible pains. What's more, the Salem girls, Ann Putnam Jr., Elizabeth Hubbard, as well as Susanna Sheldon and Mary Walcott, accused Martha of leading an army of 300 witches who coveted the position of Queen of Hell. Tragically, Martha's own children would also speak out against her, saying that they were all, in fact, witches, but that Martha was the one to have turned them evil. Her youngest daughter referred to her mother as a black cat. When Martha protested to the lot of accusations, she was charged with insanity. Martha Carrier would hang for her crimes on August 19, 1692. She wouldn't be the only person to lose her life that day. George Burroughs was a non-ordained Puritan minister who was also accused of witchcraft. You may remember he was one of the ministers who had not toughed it out in Salem Village. It's widely believed that Burroughs was accused and tried in part because of some personal vendettas against him. For one, Cotton Mather openly distrusted him as he had a sneaking suspicion that he was a closet Baptist. Baptists, you see, do not believe that you must be baptized in order to be saved. At his execution, Burroughs recited a flawless rendition of the Lord's Prayer. His rendition, it's said, moved many in the crowd to tears. What's more, many believed that it would not be something that a witch would be capable of doing. This ultimately created a feeling of doubt amongst the community. Attempting to quell the interrogative murmurs, Cotton Mathers, who was watching the spectacle, assured people that Burroughs had been righteously tried in the court of law and that he was, in fact, the leader of Satan's war against New England. Perhaps one of the most poignant vignettes of the Salem witch trials lies with the Corey family. As you may recall, Martha Corey was one of the earlier women accused of witchcraft. It turns out her husband had joined the fray of the accused back in April, after first being swept up in the initial gust of accusations. Giles Corey had initially supported the accusations against his wife, who was a salty woman, but soon he himself was accused of witchcraft by a co-accused named Abigail Hobbs. Giles Corey was a successful Salem village farmer. He was rumored to have had a violent streak and had a previous run-in with the law for allegedly beating his farmhand. He had gone to trial for the crime, but was ultimately slapped with a fine for the offense. Many folks in town, especially Thomas Putt, believed that Giles had bribed some officials in order to be set free. In a bit of a legal loophole, Giles refused to plead guilty, or not guilty, which meant that he could not be tried. What's more, he maintained his innocence, as well as refused to recognize the authority of the court, Oyer and Terminer. In order to force a plea out of him, he was subjected to pressing, a brutal form of torture. A letter written by none other than Thomas Putnam reinvigorated the idea that Giles was responsible for a previous murder for which he had gotten away scot-free. You see, Thomas reminded Judge Samuel Sewall of this fact by stating that his daughter, Ann Putnam Jr., was visited by an apparition that showed her that Giles was, at his core, a guilty man. This is the only noted official instance of pressing in American history. On September 17, 1692, Giles was stripped naked and laid out in a field, and planks of wood were placed on him. Then, large field stones were placed on the plank, slowly but effectively crushing him to death. The person overseeing the torture of Giles was Sheriff George Corwin. It should be noted here that Corwin's wife, Lydia Gedney, was the daughter of Bartholomew Gedney, one of the judges of the court of Oyer and Terminer. For 2 days, Giles withheld under torture. He did not cry in pain, he simply endured. On the second day, Sheriff Corwin asked Giles 3 times what his plea was. Each time he responded hoarsely with only 2 words, "More weight." Giles Corwin died, having never entered a plea, which, under the law, meant that his estate still belonged to him when he died. This ensured that his estate could still pass on legally to his sons, and his will dictated. It was believed, however, that Giles only did this in order to not have a guilty verdict befoul his name, even in death. He had, as it was, already secured a clear line of succession for his estate, having noted that Sheriff Corwin had attempted to illegally seize the estates of the other victims of the Salem witch trials. Martha Corey, for her part, would be executed 3 days later, on September 22nd, along with seven other accused: Margaret Scott, Mary Eastie, Alice Parker, Anne Putador, Wilmont Red, Samuel Wardell, and Mary Parker. This would mark the last of the hangings. The public nature of Giles' torture and death was a pivotal moment for the Salem witch trials. Public sentiment began to shift. After all, Giles was an 81-year-old man, and the gruesome nature of his death seemed to jolt the community awake as to their responsibility as Christians. Doubt, in other words, began to permeate the community. In 1693, the relatively newly appointed governor of the colony, William Phipps, upon hearing that his own wife was accused of witchcraft, finally decided to put an end to all the madness. The trials still sputtered out for a bit, but by May of 1693, all of those that remained in jail awaiting trial had been pardoned. The hysteria had officially ended. Now, all that remained was a community coming out of a collective daze. In its totality, the series of events from start to finish surrounding the Salem witch trials lasted 7 months. By the end of the Salem witch trials, around 200 people were accused of witchcraft, with 19 people being executed and another 5 dying in jail. Some people actually say that it was 24 people that were executed. It was the largest trial of its kind in America, and to this day, the most well-known example of mass hysteria on record. There was, of course, no concrete proof of any witchcraft being used at all at the time. As we said, historically, it's accepted as a case of mass hysteria, fueled by the stressors of early colonial life, feeding off the sputtering end of the witch trials in the early modern period that took the lives of tens of thousands of people in Europe. What happened in Salem was small in comparison. However, its imprints were far-reaching for the future of the United States. Many historians believe the events at Salem informed the eventual shattering of theocracy. It was highly influential to the refinement of the U.S. judicial system and its history altogether. There are also some other theories as to what may have happened in Salem. One more theory is more scientific as opposed to social, and this would be the poisoning. Although it's not widely accepted, it's nonetheless pretty interesting. In the late 1970s, a theory began floating around that the brief and sudden illnesses that the young girls experienced was perhaps a bout of ergotism, or ergo poisoning. This is a disease contracted by ingesting expired rye. Rotting rye could have been the product of the harsh winter experienced by the community, followed by a very damp spring. When the rye rots, it's replaced by a fungus that can make the rye look simply sunburnt. But when ingested, rotting rye can cause convulsions, muscle spasms, the sensation of crawling under the skin. Remember the pins comment from some of the girls? In addition, the fungus can cause delusions and severe hallucinations, as lysergic acid is the substance from which the drug LSD is synthesized. All in all, ergo poisoning is an interesting theory, but because the events in Salem lasted for months, it's highly unlikely that the young girls could have been repeatedly poisoned for that period of time in order for them to sustain their constant states of being under spiritual attack. It's more likely that being young, they made some accusations that got wildly out of hand, and once in the hands of the adults, it took a life of its own. The adults in turn used the frenzy as a way to further their own agendas. As we mentioned earlier, women were predominantly accused and tried as witches, as well as the men who proved to be a thorn in the side of some of the ruling families, like the Putnams. It does stand to reason that feuding families could have piggybacked off of the afflicted girls' statements in order to exert power over each other. What's more, It's interesting to note that it was the young girls, typically the voiceless members of the patriarchal society, who were inexplicably given power, their words taken at face value during the events that unfolded. Overall, the presence of a religion-centered government proved disastrous for the community, as the burden of due process under the law seemed to fly right out the window, along with reason. One of the most haunting aspects of the Salem witch trials is the idea that a community can manufacture its own demise, as opposed to standing under a unified banner. Although there is no concrete certainty as to what caused the events in Salem, it stands to reason that it was a perfect storm of events that brewed up this entire situation. Well, that's it for me today. I hope you enjoyed this bonus episode on this spooky Friday the 13th, and I'll see you all next Tuesday for our regular lineup of haunted history.